Session number 17551, Reel 1.
Mr. Wilson, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Liverpool.
Which year was this?
1918.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Liverpool?
Yes, I did, yes.
Where did you go to school?
School called Liverpool College.
How old were you when you left there?
17.
So we're talking about 1935?
Yeah.
And from there to?
I was in business in Liverpool.
What kind of business was that?
Well, first of all, in retail grocery, as an apprentice, actually, a rather large firm called Cooper's that was similar to Fortnum and Mason in scale, you know, and delivered things. And then I went into the family business, which was wholesale provisions, which is why I was trying to learn something about the retail side before I went into the wholesale. And there I was until I joined the Air Force in 1940.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast declaring war on Germany?
Yes, I did, yes.
Under what circumstances?
In the family home in Grassendale, which is about a couple of miles from where we are now.
How did you react and feel about that?
Well, it seemed inevitable after everything that had happened in the previous year. You know, the Munich and the invasion of, final invasion of Czechoslovakia and such like. So it wasn't any great surprise that it came to that, I don't think. I know my parents were sunk in gloom, I suppose the only word to say, you know, as a result, because of course they'd been right through the First World War and they thought that was it.
Were you sunk in gloom yourself?
Pardon?
Were you sunk in gloom yourself?
No, I wasn't, no.
Why not?
I don't know, it's just a different attitude when you're 20 and 21. I was 21 3 weeks after the war broke out.
Were you in favour of the declaration of war on Germany?
I thought it was inevitable at that point.
What happened to you between then and joining the RAF?
Well, I was on hold with the RAF. I mean, I'd, as it were, joined up with the RAF. Yeah. Sometime in 1939. But their training system was sort of not operating to the scale they needed in wartime. So my actual call-up was deferred until April 1940. I was part of their riposte for the invasion of Norway.
What did that involve as far as you were concerned personally?
Of being called up?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I went to Padgate, which most people in the northern half of the country went to, which is near Warrington, which is a kind of place where they gave you your uniform and gave you the various inoculations and vaccinations that you had to have. But you didn't stay there very long, perhaps about a week or 2 weeks. Then you went to initial training, ITW, at I went to Hastings, number 5 ITW, where the flight commander was Dan Maskell, who used to hear at Wimbledon every year. And we learned things like Morse code and the operation of the Browning gun and such like. Marched up and down the front at Hastings, which was still trying to pretend there wasn't a war in April. Just before the Germans moved into the Low Countries and France. But the sort of band was playing in the bandstand and sort of end of the pier parties were being held, you know, and had quite a good orchestra in Hastings as well. Used to go to the concerts. And of course the balloon went up. They knocked down most of the pier, and we were moved on to Torquay to finish our initial training.
What happened at Torquay?
Well, we carried on the same as we were doing in Hastings, just that they thought we were in the way, being non-combatant troops, as it were. Because from Hastings you could see the great pillar of smoke over Dunkirk.
Did you feel at that time that the Germans would invade?
I don't think it occurred to us, really, that they would, you know. The Germans went sort of... I think the morale of the whole country was fairly high, actually. There's something about air crew. We were besotted by flying, you know, to a large extent, I mean. And it didn't really matter to us, the circumstances, you know.
Why should people be besotted by flying at that time, do you think?
1930s?
Yes.
Well, it was a new thing. It's like going into radio, or wireless, as we called it then, or anything else that was new. You know, it was sort of part of the new technology and everything of the time, as people these days might be interested in television and computer science and such like, because they are up to the minute thing, you know.
And after Torquay?
After Torquay, I did my navigation training, first of all at Hamble, which was Air Services training on Southampton water, really. We didn't stay there very long, and we moved to a new airfield at a place called Watchfield, which was near where the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers place still is, actually. And also, it's near the little town of Farringdon, and not far from Swindon. And within a bus journey of Oxford, actually. So, there we did our navigation training. I think we were almost the last people to be trained in this country, because they were getting the Canadian and Rhodesian schemes going, you know, but I think most of the people who trained after me went overseas.
What kind of navigation techniques were you being instructed in 1940?
Dead reckoning, mainly. We had a Mercator's chart. We had a little analog computer called a CSC, a course and speed calculator. And one of the things they did, which was really quite interesting, they cut an inch, square inch, out of a 1-inch ordnance survey map, you see, so we had a square mile. And it would usually have some feature in the middle of it, or somewhere like a crossroads or a church or something, you see. And what you had to do was to navigate yourself to this spot and photograph it to prove you'd been there, and then go home again. There's usually a place about 100 miles, 150 miles away, you see. So it's quite skilled. It's, as you know, I'm sure, that the point of air navigation is getting the correct wind all the time, because wind is fickle, much more than ocean current. So you're constantly trying to find your angle of drift, you know. And sort of checking and rechecking. So if you get it right, it's rather satisfying, actually.
Did you personally have any problems with the course?
Not really, no. I enjoyed it, actually.
How did you view the prospect of fighting in the air?
I don't know. I don't think we just took it as part of the job, I suppose. It's always going to happen to somebody else, you know. Somebody else will be shot down, somebody else will be killed, somebody else will be wounded. Not you. I mean, I think the same attitude applies today to some extent. You know, the same kind of people who flew the Spitfires are the same kind of people who ride motorbikes for all the first.
And after your period in Oxfordshire?
Then we moved to right into the north of Scotland, a place called Eventon, which was between Inverness and Invergordon. And there's an airfield there, partly RAF and partly Fleet Air Arm. And there we did bombing and gunnery in an obsolete bomber called a Harrow, as far as the bombing was concerned, and the gunnery in a... the gunnery in the Harrow and the bombing in Fairy Battles.
What were the main techniques in those spheres that you had to master?
Well, primitive, I would say. As far as the air gunnery is concerned, you had to sort of try and hit a drogue which was towed about 300 yards behind an aeroplane, another plane. And it's just a question of trying to learn the kind of amount of deflection you needed in order to hit something. Much as fighter pilots had to learn that because they didn't have any other thing except their skill. As far as bomb aiming was concerned, you had a kind of thing which you moved this way or that way, and you got it until the thing you were aiming at was going down the lines here to a certain point there, and then when it got to that sort of bead or whatever it was, you dropped the bomb, you see, and theoretically it would hit the target, which it did occasionally. The thing was that the plane's going like that, of course, and the wind has a certain amount of thing, so the margin of error was pretty great. It always amuses me when people say, well, they must have been aiming at some particular point in Liverpool, where in fact all they were trying to do was hit the docks, which is a fairly big target, but they weren't. I mean, the way the Germans aimed their bombs were exactly the same as ours in those days. Later on they had gyroscopically stabilised bomb sites, which helped a lot. And nowadays, of course, they're sort of homed in by radar, I think. But it was very primitive, really.
Did the German Air Force ever attempt to raid the bases where you were training?
Not the training bases. Though I think they did attack Hamble after we'd left, which was near Southampton, of course. And was probably being used mainly as a fighter pilot, the base-ish thing.
What date approximately have we reached when you were in northeast Scotland?
Well, I went there in the early autumn of 1940, probably about October.
And how long would you be there for?
I was there for 3 months, until the end of the year, really, so about December.
And then?
Then we were awarded our brevets, as it were, and sent on leave for, I think, 10 days. And then we were posted to squadrons. As it happened, I was posted to a coastal command squadron.
Which one was that?
217, based in St. Evil, in Cornwall. They were just being rearmed with Bristol Beauforts, having just getting rid of their Avro Ensigns. Anybody who's ever flown in Ensigns will remember them, because they had retractable undercarriages, but they were retracted mechanically. And you had to turn the handle, I think it was 135 times, to get the thing up or down. And It was quite stiff, so your left arm felt as if it was dropping off by the time you'd finished.
You actually flew in Anson's, did you?
We did our navigation training in Anson's. I didn't fly with them on the squadron. But the squadron was really in a sort of, I suppose you call it, training mode when I joined it, to learn how about the Beaufort. And we set off on various kind of training things. I remember one where we had to go round various lighthouses from Valencia in southwest Ireland and the Calf of Man. And Menor Bridge, I remember, and again photographed them to prove you'd been there. That was quite interesting.
What was it like flying in the Beaufort?
It was noisy, I suppose you'd call it, but they were underpowered, actually, as a plane, but I haven't got much to compare them with, you see, because I didn't really fly in any other operational plane except the Beaufort. But we had an adequate accommodation for navigation. We had quite a good table, big enough to take a Mercator chart and all the gear that we carried around with us. We were in the nose of the plane, the observers, as of course they called us in those days, not navigators, but still the same thing. And we had a Browning gun which fired backwards. We had a kind of mirror, and the feed went like a sort of S-bend round. To the result was, if you did try to fire the thing, it usually jammed up to about 3 shots, so the whole thing was pretty hopeless. Anyway, because we also had an air gunner and a wireless operator, and a forward-firing Browning gun, which was under control of the pilot.
So a four-man crew?
Four-man crew, yes.
How did you crew up?
I don't know, really. They were fairly arbitrary, I think. There was my pilot, a man called Rents, who was later with the BBC, World Service. And I think later than that with BBC Two in its early days. I met him once just after the war, well, not just after the war, but 25 years after we were shot down in 66. And we had a couple of drinks together and a dinner in the BBC club, which was quite jolly. But we exchanged Christmas cards for several years, but I haven't had one from him for a couple of years, and it seemed to me that he'd probably, I don't know, either died or moved away or something. Anyway, I lost contact with him.
Do you remember anything about the other two members of the crew?
Bunny Austin, who the air gunner, I remember. He's quite a character, really. I think he probably earned quite a good living on the black market after the war. Chiplin went down with the plane, Chippy we called him. His father worked in the Cumberland Hotel as their kind of resident engineer.
You know, is this in London?
In near Marble Arch, you know the one. It's quite a biggish hotel. He, I suppose, supervised the lifts and any other bits of machinery they have in a hotel, a large hotel like that.
And so the plane was just had guns with no bombs?
Oh, yes, we carried bombs, but in fact, we were supposed to be torpedo bombers, but 217 at that time didn't carry torpedoes, we carried bombs and depth charges occasionally, and occasionally mines. We began to fly operationally, I think, in about March of 1941. And, of course, being where we were at Sir Devil in Cornwall, our operations tended to be down into the Bay of Biscay and that sort of area. We quite often did night raids, dropping mines in the approaches to Brest. Or tried to drop a bomb down the funnel of the Scharnhorst to the Neisenau that were in Brest at the time. We only had comparatively small bombs, about 250-pound bombs, and they would have bounced off the armoured deck of those battleships, or those pocket battleships, I think they were. And so there wasn't... I mean, it kept them awake and irritated them. I think that's about the whole point of our raids over Brest. We also did convoy escort. I remember a very big convoy we were involved in, going down the coast of Cornwall. Passenger ships, of course, with troops on board, and a battleship ahead, and a cruiser astern, and what the Navy call an A to K line of destroyers out in front. And two of us doing what they call a Z patrol, going along the line of convoy, twice visibility ahead of the convoy, then twice visibility to port, then right across the diagonal of the convoy to twice visibility on the starboard rear of the convoy, then across to the other quarter, then zigzag across to the starboard side of the convoy. I hope that makes sense. But we were doing that, and two of us doing it in different directions. And of course, it was quite, as a dead reckoning plot, it was quite difficult because the convoy was moving, the wind was moving, and you felt you were rather on your mettle, because I don't think the Navy thought much of RAF navigation, so I thought we had to really get this properly done properly. Which both the navigators involved felt the same, you see, and we were also very pleased with ourselves when we finally landed. But,
this is in the southwest approaches.
That's right, yes. I suppose they were going out to the Middle East. I mean, that's where most of the troops were going at that time, I think. It was a very big convoy. You know, the Navy had always put a lot of work into the defence of it.
Were any of these convoys attacked whilst you were protecting?
Not while I was actually doing them, no, not that one anyway. I remember another convoy where the Navy, the only way they could communicate was by an Aldous lamp and Morse code. In the typical Navy way, they said, "Think you will find a fox bearing," whatever it was. So we set off that direction, dropped a depth charge, no visible effect, but as we got any more armament, we went, then went home. But it was, I thought it was Navy, I mean, just going round, taking this Morse code thing, and every time they send a word, you send a T back to say that you've understood it. And so it takes forever, you know, it's the most laborious way of communicating. And so...
So a fox was a U-boat, was it?
Yeah, if they just said U-boat bearing such a thing, it would have saved a lot of time, you know. So never mind. Anyway, that's the sort of thing we did anyway, a great mixture of different things. Sometimes we just went on patrols as we were looking for trouble.
When you were doing these attacks on Brest, how dangerous did it feel to you?
They had a lot of flak. It was quite dangerous. It did feel quite dangerous over the... But it was quite... It was sort of over in an instant almost, because I mean, once you got out to sea again or north of the Breton Peninsula, it sort of... There was no other kind of attack. Of course, they're just beginning to move their forces to Russia then. Russian front. So they went up, you know, the Luftwaffe in the west had been denuded to a large extent. It was nowhere near as strong as it had been during the Battle of Britain. Still strong enough. We looked a bit like a Ju-88, so they It may have helped or it may have hindered us, I don't know.
Do you think you achieved any success at Brest?
No. Now, I remember we had a raid over Cherbourg once, and we dropped a bomb, and it was a colossal green, like electric flash. So I think we must have hit a substation or something. So I suppose that caused a certain amount of damage.
What particular were you after at Cherbourg?
Well, the whole thing was oil, really, and to a large extent. They were still getting... This was before America came in the war. They were getting oil from Mexico and Venezuela, perhaps, as well. And they had these tankers, which were biggish by standards of those days, tiny by today's standards, about 15,000 ton Altmark class, if you remember the Altmark in Norway. And they came across the mid-Atlantic and then got into Spanish or Portuguese territorial waters and then came up the coast of France and went into one of the French Atlantic ports, which could be Bordeaux up the Gironde River or La Palisse or any of the others, you see, Brest and Lorient. More like to be Lorient or ones further south, but that's what they were doing. We used to go on these offensive patrols trying to find these tankers. I can